You're listening to the West Wing Weekly. My name's Hrishikesh Hirway.
And my name's Joshua Molina.
Today on the show, we're talking about Season 2, Episode 11. It's called The Leadership Breakfast.
The story was by Paul Redford. This one was written by Aaron Sorkin. I can't think of another joke to make about the fact that he writes them all. And it was directed by Scott Winant. Very good director. I know came up in early 30-something. He directed and produced a lot of early 30-somethings.
He's not the first 30-something director to come through.
That's true. We've had Ken Olin.
Mm-hmm. Here's a synopsis of the episode from TV Guide. With Congress reconvening, the White House is planning a leadership breakfast, in quotes, to encourage bipartisan cooperation. But first, Toby must meet with Ann Stark, the Senate Majority Leader's new chief of staff, to go over details. And there are plenty of devils in those details. Ann's boss, it appears, has presidential ambitions. They're coming after us, Toby tells Leo. Meanwhile, Sam wants to move the press corps to new quarters across the street, and Leo, Sam, and Donna embarrass themselves in front of an influential columnist.
There it is. What did you think of this episode?
I really liked it. I think it's a great one. What do you think?
I totally agree. I just thought it was a all-around super episode.
The performances were good. The writing was good. It's a cool show.
Scott Winant did a good job directing.
Mm-hmm. Aaron Sorkin holding his own.
Yes, he's often, really always good.
Okay.
Okay.
What's next?
Rishi, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Good. Okay, people, that of course was, we just wanted to do a version of the podcast for Gail and for others who don't like our nitpicking. And now I just thought for the other, probably half of the listenership that wants to dig a little deeper, we'll continue now.
This is the bonus edition.
Yeah, this is kind of like extras on the DVD.
You know, we just talked to Bradley Whitford, and Brad won an Emmy for Noel, but he won against his fellow castmates, Richard Schiff and John Spencer, who were also nominated for Best Supporting Actor. And they were both nominated based on this episode.
Get out of here.
Mm-hmm.
Why? I mean, they're both great. they're both always great, and they were great in this episode, but this episode doesn't leap out to me as an Emmy submission episode. Does it to you?
Not for Leo. Leo doesn't really do that much in this one, I think. Toby has a nice arc.
His arc just is from wrong to wrong.
Yeah. But you know, he has some stuff to do. It's no In Excelsis Deo.
No, but I'm trying to think now.
It's not even In Excelsis Deo.
That's so true. It's not even Deo. Deo. We have to start the podcast for real now. Something happened. We derailed ourselves with our fake beginning.
Yeah.
Aren't there great Leo and Toby episodes from this season already? I can't remember any other episodes from this season. This is where you have an advantage on me.
I mean, it is really kind of like you can pick any. You know what you're getting with the West Wing. These guys are all good.
That is also true. I mean, and I think when you get nominated, again, I wouldn't know. But I think when you get nominated for an Emmy, that really you're being acknowledged for the whole season. And they're all always great. But I would think if you were trying to pick your best example for a submission, that I don't know why it would be this episode. But that's interesting.
I'm going to nominate you for Best West Wing Weekly co-host.
Oh, I was going to nominate you. This is like the gifts of the Magi.
Yeah. The only problem is that in order to nominate you for best co-host, I had to sell the podcast.
Oh, that's right. And I did the same thing. Mm-hmm. So now the podcast has no host.
Exactly. But we both got each other the same present.
And the listenership rejoiced.
What is happening?
Let me ask you this. There probably are podcast awards. And if there aren't, why don't we invent them and somehow make money from that?
There are podcast awards. I've won some.
You did? Oh, tell me about it. I'm most comfortable working with people who are lauded and awarded for their work while I sit in the shadows. So I'm delighted to hear that even here it's the case.
Yes, there are podcast awards that you've never heard of that I've won.
Are they called the Potties?
No. I mean, there are some, I don't know.
Yes, you do. What are they called? And what have you won? And I'm looking at your studio and you have lots of nice stuff. Where are the awards?
I haven't yet moved them over in here. When we get a Peabody, then I'll be excited.
Mr. Peabody?
Mm-hmm. When somebody gives us a dog.
Don't send us dogs. It's a joke. We're here still to talk about The West Wing, right?
Yes. Yes. Let's start from the beginning. At the beginning of this episode, in our cold open, emphasis on cold, Sam and Josh are in buddy-buddy mode in a way that I feel like we haven't really seen since the flashback in The Shadow of Two Gunmen when they go and get a hot dog.
Yes, early Josh and Sam. That's true. And I wrote down that they looked cute in their winter togs. Didn't they?
They did look cute. I mean, the whole thing was cute.
Rob Lowe has a good run of cuteness in this episode.
Oh, man. And when...
I'm going to get you started on his handsomeness. Let's just talk about his cuteness.
His cuteness, for sure.
You know what we could use? Newspaper? See, this is what I'm talking about. This is teamwork. It really is.
Yeah, it's another one of those he has... Maybe we need a name for it. There's a thing that Sam does. There's one in Celestial Navigation where he and Toby are driving around and he's so excited when he finally finds the police station. It's that same moment of just pure, genuine Sam Seaborn delight.
I think we can call it he Chris Traeger's.
Nice. So are there Traeger warnings?
Oh, very good.
Well, good enough.
Good enough for a nomination. I'm going to stop talking about this.
Why won't you tell me what they're called? What are they called?
It was the most recent thing that I won was the Academy of Podcasters.
I can't believe you've won stuff and you don't remember what it's called. That tells me you've won too much stuff.
It was the Academy of Podcasters.
And that was for Song Exploder?
Yeah, I won Best Music Show.
What if you win an award for this show and I don't? And I become just bitter and awful, and I won't admit what it is, but I just start turning on you, and I'm horribly cruel.
Throughout this whole episode, as I was writing my notes, I kept writing. I wrote it once, and then I kept writing it over and over again. I kept writing, Trump, ay, ay, ay.
I basically did the same thing.
Really?
Where I couldn't tease that. I didn't write ay, 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 but I just wrote Trump down a lot. So clearly... things are resonating, but then I couldn't even think of a second word to add, which is, it's sort of my brain kind of short circuits as soon as I think of anything to do with the ridiculous circus that the pre-Trump administration already is.
Right.
It's like, I can't even form thoughts. So lots of little things would go ding during this episode as I watch, and they're like, ah, what is there to say about it?
This is an episode where the dissonance between what's on the show and what we're experiencing in the real world seems like a huge gulf. The whole conflict of the episode hinges on a conflict between what Toby says in the press about the speaker.
Right.
And it's so damn quaint. Now, in this context, the whole idea of like that they're up in arms about the fact that Toby said that they were going to attach an amendment on the wage hike.
In the back, Simon.
Congressman, I'm quoting a senior White House aide who says they have the votes. The aide said that unless they get a straight up or down vote from the leader, and this is the quote, we're going to attach it as an amendment to everything that moves.
This is what the controversy was. This is what the scandal was.
I thought the same thing, too. I'm like, you guys are adorable thinking this would be a big deal. Like, oh, if you could transport to 2016 and see what people are saying about each other and what politicians tweet about each other. And I mean, it's so beyond the pale that, yeah, this is like a little nothing.
And the things that really ought to be scandals that get, you know, swept under the rug. It's crazy. Like, there's a sense of politesse in the whole thing that is just completely foreign now.
Traditionally, these kinds of things are done in front of the White House.
Traditionally, the person in my job has cared what's traditional.
And the idea that she's bucking tradition and causing all this like mayhem by insisting the briefing happens on the Hill instead of at the White House. It's just baffling.
This little argument about optics.
Yeah. And so this is one where it's not even just like a little detail of like, oh, this is a little relic from yesteryear. The whole conflict of this episode now feels outdated.
I agree. It felt like... small stakes.
Yeah. And in summary, Trump, ay, ay, ay.
Trump, ay, ay, ay. Yeah, I ended up enjoying this episode mainly for its funny moments and lighthearted banter and the underpants story. And that ongoing Karen Cahill thing I thought was funny and clever. It was almost like a little Curb Your Enthusiasm episode where one thing leads to another, leads to another, leads to a ridiculous denouement. It was, I thought it was funny and well done. But you're right. The higher stakes aspect of it felt depressingly low stakes.
Yeah.
And I think that's not a fault of anybody involved in the West Wing, but rather the fault of the current political climate and situation.
The decline of Western civilization.
Yes, that.
That Karen Cahill subplot. Karen Cahill is supposed to be Maureen Dowd.
I wrote down Karen Cahill equals question mark Maureen Dowd. Mm-hmm. So I guess I figured it out. I'm very clever that way. Well, Aaron Sorkin had a relationship of some kind or other with Maureen Dowd.
Mm-hmm. But she is apparently very scary to some people in politics, or at least she was back in these milder days.
Huh. Yeah, well, I can say, I mean, she's certainly sharp of pen and very smart. And my wife and I got to spend a little time with her in Jamaica at Dulé Hill's wedding.
Jesus, you're a movie star. Look at this. This is sometimes.
Look at me and my glamorous.
Yeah, I cannot even
I've never
relate.
Been nominated for a flotty podcast Academy of thing.
I'll trade you my Academy of Podcasters Award for
Aaron Sorkin and Maureen Dowd.
Yeah.
Yeah. All I can say is she is very, very smart and a delightful person. Mm-hmm. But I suppose if you were among the group of people about whom she writes, it might be a little bit more intimidating to hang out with her.
Yeah.
There was no chance I was going to show up in an op-ed piece.
Let's play the story that we were saving from Emily Proctor about a possible inspiration for the Karen Cahill subplot, or at least part of it.
It's so embarrassing. So what happened was, Tommy says to me one day, would you like to come have lunch in the Warner Brothers executive dining room and discuss your future? And I thought, well, gosh, lunch, dining room, and future. Huh. That isn't even a question. That's just a when and where do I show up? And so I got there first. And I remember that was, you know, in that time, like jeans, you just kind of always wear a dark jean and some sort of a top. And so I walked into this place and I remember I had, you know, laundromat, washed everything, one big bundle, pulled my jeans out, put them on, had on some sort of a shirt. And I had this little tiny gray bag with some sparkles on it. And I thought, well, I'm going to take this because it seems like serious and fun. But I walked and I sat down and the waiter came over and he was like, can I get you anything? And I was like, no, thank you. I'm fine. And he said, you're meeting someone. And I said, yes, sir, I'm meeting someone, yes. And he walked away and it was very, you know, heavy-handed. And Tommy comes up and he sits down and the waiter comes up and he's like, have you had a chance to look at the menu? And it went on enough that he left one time and I turned to Tommy. I was like, what is going on with this guy? He's like being so weird to me. And then he said to me, he came back and he said, do you have everything? And I said, what do you mean, do I have everything? And he said, could you perhaps have lost something? And I said, oh, something from my bag? And he said, yes. And I said, oh, my gosh, I don't know. And so it's about yay big. And I look in there and I'm like, I've got my money and my key and my lipstick and my license. And I'm like, no, I don't have anything. And he said, you didn't lose anything personal.
Oh, my God.
And I said,
oh,
you're dear. Being very cryptic.
Oh, my God.
And I said, I have to ask you, you mean like some underwear? He goes, yes. And he said, look in my pocket. And he was wearing a white waiter jacket. And I pulled him in his pocket. And I was like, oh, my God, my underwear are in there. And I was like, those are my underwear. And I'll never forget Tommy looking at me and saying, why didn't you just lie? To this day, right. I'm like, I don't know. I do not know why I did not lie.
Oh, my God, that's a good story.
The only thing I can think is that they were in like my pant leg and just sort of like remained there until the perfect embarrassing moment. Why didn't I lie?
Okay, back to the present. I love that story, and I'm glad that we saved it until now.
Can I tell you my real life story that this Karen Cahill thing reminded me of?
Yeah.
1985, summer after my freshman year in college, and my older sister Toby and I decided to drive cross country together. Great fun. Had a ball. Lots of adventures. And at one stop, I think in Idaho, I want to say perhaps Boise, Idaho, we were at a restaurant and we were living like, you know, kind of, you know, like out of our car and then in motels and occasional camping, dirty clothes and, you know, just kind of like getting through the summer. And we had dinner. And the waiter came over with the check, and my sister Toby reached into her purse to pay and pulled out her wallet and a pair of panties. And it was incredibly embarrassing. Mm-hmm. I think it was just because, you know, we were going to laundry or something like that. And we couldn't even form a sentence. We just laughed and cried. And the waiter, this was really, really embarrassing and fabulous. But that's what this Karen Cahill story reminded me of.
Mm-hmm. Well, it also reminds me, I mean, it does more than remind me. It is an echo of a Sports Night episode when Something Wicked This Way comes. Dan goes and meets Hillary Clinton for a fundraising breakfast, and he confuses secular and non-secular.
Someone had clearly briefed her on my stuff with the public schools, and I told her about my opposition to secular programs that are publicly financed. I really spoke up, and she seemed to listen.
You mean non-secular?
What do you mean?
You don't oppose secular programs that are publicly financed. You oppose non-secular programs that are publicly financed.
Yes.
It's basically the same thing as the Kyrgyzstan Kazakhstan storyline.
And I have to say that I made some very scholarly points regarding the remaining nuclear weapons in Kyrgyzstan, and I have to believe not
Kazakhstan. Nuclear weapons are in Kazakhstan.
Is it Kyrgyzstan?
Yeah.
But in the Sports Night one, it was about Hillary Clinton. Trump, aye.
I had my first Trump aye moment, I'm realizing now, during the previously on. Leo says,
this president was elected with 48% of the vote, Toby.
Yes, but he was elected.
Without a mandate, the majority of people in the country voted for somebody else.
And I thought, Trump,
Yeah.
46%.
Yeah, we've, of course, discussed that moment in the past, but now it takes on a whole new pitch and darkness.
Bartlett is the anti-Trump.
Yes.
I mean, the idea, can you imagine Bartlett sitting in his office bitterly tweeting at 3 a.m. because he didn't win the popular vote. it's so funny. I mean, it's just, he's everything our actual president-elect is not.
They do share some things in that neither of them knows how to work a computer.
Well, there you go. That's true.
I had another Trump IAA moment, at least two others. One, there was this whole notion about the press and their proximity to the president.
And we can put a little physical distance between the press and the president, and we can put them just across the street in the state-of-the-art facility.
By state-of-the-art, you mean?
A room with electricity.
The press doesn't want physical distance from the president, and the American people would prefer the president didn't have physical distance from the press.
CJ.
We can't exile the press.
Donald Trump, of course, would like to remove them altogether.
Yeah, exactly. Sorry, American people.
Not gonna happen. I did think we're back to CJ being terribly undermined at work by her male colleagues this episode.
God. Yeah.
Right? I mean, just, especially what Toby did to her.
Are you ordering me to move it to the Hill?
I don't like doing that.
You're gonna have to.
Do it.
I mean, I understand where he's coming from. He thinks he's, for him, it's an easy trade to trade off the optics of this event in return for getting 15 minutes of discussion about a topic that's important to him. But I loved when CJ just said it to him. He said, but you cut my legs out from under me.
Yeah.
In terms of Ann Stark. Felicity's good in the role, and she makes you kind of hate her and really root for CJ versus Ann.
There was another line, another Trump IAI line. It was just so on the nose when the president is reading what Sam has written for the leadership breakfast.
There's a lot more that unites Americans than divides them.
I mean, this whole idea of finding compromise and the middle ground, I don't know, maybe that's evergreen, but it just seems like they have no idea what kind of rancor could actually exist.
That's true. This whole thing, there's a lot more that unites Americans than divides them, says Bartlett.
There were other clever things in this episode. There were these little call and response moments, I thought. The president says to Charlie,
even though it's a handshake, I'm able to make him feel like a friend, and that's a little thing they call people skills.
When he's talking about meeting the bronze medalist from Singapore.
Right.
Even though he gets her gender wrong.
That made me laugh out loud.
So he says, that's a little thing they call people skills. And then just moments later, Donna tells Sam,
I connect with people, Sam.
Yes.
I'm a people person.
That's great. You're going to the South Street exhibit.
I have nothing beyond that. Just that, those were two moments that were very similar.
Really funny moments.
Yeah.
I found the first evidence I've ever seen that the closed captioning person fell asleep onto his or her keyboard during the show. I'm going to send you the scene where they're working on the seating.
Yeah.
And
in the cold open.
Right. And CJ says that they've been working for 7.5 hours. And here's the image. The closed captioning person wrote 7/1/2 hours. I honestly think it was a cardiac arrest or a quick nap, narcolepsy or something. And the closed captioning person fell on their keyboard.
It looks like it says 71 and then there are 5 slashes and then a 2.
Yeah. That's not how you write 7.5. Unless you've been drinking.
I think you're right. That's really great.
Yeah, I do. I actually do. They just didn't, they went and didn't go back and correct it.
Everybody really should watch with the closed captioning on just because there's apparently a whole other show that you could be experiencing at the same time.
Right. Yes. The closed captioning people are trying to say stuff to us. I'm being held. Send help to this address.
Do you remember in the episode, our episode on the West Wing episode, Enemies, we talked about stuff and I remember I felt like you were a little impressed by something I said about making the distinction between enemies versus opponents.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
it came from this episode.
Yeah. Like everything that might possibly sound smart that comes out of my mouth. It's just something that it's just something that I stole from the West Wing.
I don't think that's true, but
I just forgot.
I'm starting to think that the things that I believe Aaron has pinched from me, I pinched from Aaron. Like I did that with, you know, I'll give you $1,000 for it. Yeah. By the way, a lot of people pointed out that that's apparently a prominent line in the movie Three Men and a Baby, which I don't think I've ever seen, but apparently it's a thing. Hmm. But there was another line in here, and I was thinking, I always say that. And then I thought, maybe this is why I always say that. Maybe I'm getting the chronology wrong. And the award-winning famous writer is the one who came up with these things first.
Maybe you're always saying it just because you've been cast in so many things that Aaron has written and he's given you that line.
It's possible. It's possible.
It's a line from A Few Good Men that you've actually said on stage hundreds of times. But yeah, Leo says,
the Republicans aren't the enemy, they're the opposition.
I was embarrassed for myself.
Well, maybe Aaron got it from you. No, that doesn't make sense. The timeline doesn't work on that.
Is the thing that you always say, I could care less, because we get that line again.
I could care less who says what.
I did notice that again. I now believe that that's a character thing. Toby says that because we've heard it said correctly by others.
Right. The president said it correctly.
So it's a nice little Aaron Toby touch.
Yeah. Oh, back to the cold open. We get Ed and Larry there. And
yes, I wrote, we get our Ed and Larry on again, finally.
I was watching Westworld. And I saw Peter James Smith on there.
I haven't started watching that yet. I know I'm going to like it.
It's such a funny response that I have to see. I mean, I've met Peter when we did our podcast and we've like exchanged some tweets, but I certainly don't know him. But seeing him on that show, I just had this feeling of warmth. It was like seeing my family member on the news for something great that they did. There's no logic to it at all.
That's very sweet. You felt proud of him. Is his character at all Ed-like?
Not really. I mean, maybe. Yeah, he's sort of like a guy who's in one scene to get something done. Sure. He's Ed-like.
Okay. I mean, I assume he's not at all like Larry.
No, God, no. Nothing like it. God. No. I liked in the cold open also that between Sam and Josh and Donna is the voice of reason. And then later, Charlie is the voice of utter exasperation.
What are you doing?
Somebody started a fire in this fireplace, Charlie.
If the smoke alarms go off, they're going to make me wake up the president. The president's
up. Sam and Josh are talking about the merits of different woods and how to build the fire. And Donna's sort of like, I think this is a bad idea. And then eventually they like start the fire. And Charlie skips the, I think this is a bad idea, and just comes in and is like, what the hell? Because he has to go wake up the president.
Yeah, right.
Which is very funny way to start the episode.
Sam is like a little mini Bartlett at times in terms of his knowledge about arcane topics.
Yeah.
The amount of information he has, for instance, about wood. Very Bartlett-like.
Yeah, but it's really, some of it's pretty specious. It sounds like he knows. Like, I always think about the line from the president where he says, sometimes I'm just making it up.
Sam's the same way, you think?
We're just going along with him because he's normally otherwise brilliant. I did love, I think this was the other moment that you were referring to in terms of Sam's cute trigger warning moment when he is asked to go speak to Karen Cahill.
Yes.
And Donna asks him and he says,
"What happens?"
"I become unimpressive."
"In what way?"
"In many ways."
"Hi." "You don't fall down, do you?"
"When?"
"With Karen."
"Once."
"You'll be fine."
"You think?"
"You'll be impressive."
"I never have been before, but that's no reason to think I'm not going to do it."
"Right."
"You know why?"
"It doesn't really matter."
"Perseverance. You get right back on the horse. I'm going to sit there and she's going to go home saying, that Sam Seaborn's impressive."
And really in the course of like less than a minute, he manages to turn himself completely around and do a 180 and be like, "I'm going to do this. I'm going to nail it." You know, Donna's like,
"Reach for the stars, Sam."
"I will."
"Good."
It reminded me of, did you watch Arrested Development?
I did indeed.
One of my favorite parts from that show was when Lindsay and Tobias are talking about having an open marriage.
"You know, Lindsay, as a therapist, I have advised a number of couples to explore an open relationship where the couple remains emotionally committed, but free to explore extramarital encounters."
"Well, did it work for those people?"
"No, it never does. I mean, these people somehow delude themselves into thinking it might, but... but it might work for us."
That's hilarious.
It's one of my favorite things.
It's a neat trick that Aaron pulls off, actually, that this entire comic Karen Cahill subplot happens off camera. I mean, mm-hmm. You just see the consequences of each off-camera interaction. And we've never seen, nor will we ever, Karen Cahill. And yet it's this kind of a creation of a character in our minds. And yeah. The whole thing works.
Mm-hmm. There was this little theme in the episode of impressing people. Sam being unimpressive or impressive to Karen Cahill. Leo saying,
"I don't like dealing with people who are trying to impress me."
And then Toby himself trying to impress Anne Stark. It feels a little bit like he's showing off in front of her.
Yeah, they felt with Felicity and Richard like there was some sort of either history, some past between these two characters, or some attempt, or the way she...
Oh, for sure.
Right? It's interesting. It was kind of charged with a little something that was never quite acknowledged explicitly.
They've definitely made out. "I know her a little," he says.
Mm-hmm.
She says,
"What should I wear?"
"I don't give a damn.
I've heard different..."
It's dripping with subtext.
But not backstory. Oh, no. Don't create backstory, people. Don't guess what happened.
I don't have a great point to make about this, but there's the part where Leo says,
"Alexander Hamilton didn't think we should have political parties. Neither did John Adams. They thought political parties led to divisiveness."
"They do. They should. We have honest disagreements. Arguments are good."
"Only if they lead to statesmanship. Or it's just theater."
And I thought, or musical theater.
You quoted musical theater on Twitter. People were very excited. People are sensing a conversion. It was a climate change, right? Oceans rise.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But people were very excited. "Are you leaving the dark side and coming over to the light?" It's a great song.
It's such a good song. When you saw Hamilton, was Jonathan Groff King George?
No. I saw the original, Brian D'Arcy James.
Okay.
And I'm sure Jonathan Groff is fantastic, and I've listened to his version, of course, 8 million times. But at the Public off Broadway before the Broadway run, it was Brian D'Arcy James. I saw the second preview pre-Broadway. I'm actually quite curious. Of course, you know what my retention is like. So although I'm curious now to see what all the changes are that have been made, but I probably won't remember what any of them are because my brain doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm curious to see the transformation from off Broadway to Broadway. But yeah, I saw the second preview. In a lot of ways, I feel like I wrote the show.
Well, so when I saw it, they were on to their fourth King George III, who was played by Rory O'Malley, and he was so good.
Is he great?
He was my favorite part of the show.
Yeah, really?
And that's saying a lot because so much of it was great, but he really just was amazing, I thought.
That's fantastic.
And I've had the King George numbers in my head on a loop since seeing it.
I'm hoping that in the final 6 months of the show's run in the year 2039, that I will play that role.
King George?
If I'm still alive.
Mm.
Yeah, there's some high notes, but I think with the right pants, I could play the role.
I could see you playing that role.
You're very kind.
I could see you relishing the mischief of that character.
You're kind to say. Now, I don't sing like a Jonathan Groff or Brian D'Arcy James, but I feel like when the show's running out of air, it'd be a good time to put me in. You're like, he was on West Wing 50 years ago.
You should just wear the crown and cape between now and whenever they make that decision, just to drive it home.
Just that I'm ready.
Exactly. Show, demonstrate that you're ready.
I do sing it a lot at home.
On that note, let's take a quick break. And now back to the show. Here's another reference outside of the West Wing. This is the emergence of the reference to Leo as a wartime conciliary.
Yes.
Which we talked about when I compared him to Jorah Mormont.
Oh, that's right. Oh, there's another little... I wanted Anne Stark to be somehow related to the Game of Thrones House of Stark.
Mm.
I wanted her to get red weddinged.
You wanted her to be executed by the end of it.
Indeed.
It was interesting. Leo talks about this is not interesting. I don't know why I started this off with this is interesting.
I'll be the judge of that.
These are the mad ramblings of.
This is a weird rambling conversation we're having.
Yeah. Wartime conciliary. Oh, that's from The Godfather. In The Godfather, Michael Corleone says to Tom Hagen, played by Robert Duvall, Tom Hagen is told he isn't a wartime conciliary. And part of the reason why is because he's not Sicilian.
He's Irish.
He's Irish. And at the beginning of the episode, Josh says to Leo,
and what stupid-ass Irish thing did you say to Karen Cahill that you now need me to apologize for at Ben and Sally's like a little girl?
Dude, not interesting. That's brilliant. That's award-winning right there. I would give you a casty in a second for that little riff. No, actually, I buy it. I like it.
Casty, where you just come over and break my arm and you say, congratulations.
Congratulations, you've won a casty. Next year, I'm going to submit my leg.
At the end of the episode, Toby and Leo say, they shake hands and Leo says,
son of a bitch. Shake my hand. We just formed it.
Formed what?
The committee to re-elect the president.
Committee to re-elect the president is an awful lot like the committee for the re-election of the president, aka CREEP.
Wow. Wow.
Right? It's a lot like committee for the re-election of the president was the name of the organization behind the Watergate scandal.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was supposed to be abbreviated CRP, but everybody called it CREEP.
CREEP.
It's funny that Leo invokes that same acronym.
Yeah, well done. I actually got moved by that moment.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It's like where they, I didn't think, I was enjoying this episode really solely as it, like, make me laugh. I'm enjoying the laughing moments and then intermittently just writing down the word Trump. Mm-hmm. and then at that final moment, I thought, oh, wait a minute. I just got caught up. I got a little tingle there.
Oh, that's nice.
Like, it's on. I like these it's on moments.
Here's a nitpick for Gail.
Bring it. No, she had her version. We're all cool with nitpicks here.
All right. CJ has a deputy that we have never met or even ever heard of. Henry.
Henry, yes. Henry, get out of there. Come home. Henry, come home.
Who the hell is Henry?
I don't know. A less compelling off-camera character than Karen Cahill.
Yeah. but what was interesting about Henry's inclusion off-screen is that on-screen, Carol gets a lot more to do in terms of her role in the press secretary's office. She's in there negotiating with Anne Stark's aides on what they might give and take on the guidelines for the leadership breakfast. And I thought, that's nice. It's nice to see Carol has a role beyond just handing notes to CJ. Like, she's not just her sort of secretary. She's actually involved in decision-making.
Yes, I agree. That is true. Speaking of Anne Stark, staff aide number one was played by Mark Goldsmith.
How do you know Mark?
I don't know.
Okay. Good story.
You know how I have trouble remembering earlier episodes?
Mm-hmm.
That includes episodes from my life.
I'm glad we talked about in our first episode how we met, so then you'll be able to remember that later on.
Yes.
You do remember how we met,
right? I might have to go back and listen to it. But, you know, that I do remember. I still remember. Oh, look, I just noticed as I'm gazing at the IMDb list for this episode that Henry Hansen, I can't tell you who that character is, but he was played by Bruce Wynant. Little nepotism. I'm guessing, it could be wrong, that he's related to Scott Wynant. He seems to be a major casting director. So if you're hearing this, give me work. Bruce Wynant, a sometime actor and an off-time casting director. And I'm going to guess Scott Wynant's brother.
That must be CJ's deputy.
But wait a minute. But he's not on camera ever, is he?
I didn't realize it. Maybe he's in the meeting.
Maybe he's
with
milling
Ann
around
Stark.
There.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, well, there you go.
So maybe he was actually on.
Just blew the lid off some Hollywood nepotism right there.
Mm-hmm. Or maybe he had some scenes and they got cut.
Well, wait a minute. The intrigue grows as I noticed that on his IMDb page, he has alternate names, including Bruce Nielsen, Jace Reeves, Joseph Stills, Loopers Unlimited, Jim Warrington, Bruce Nelson Wynant, and Bruce Nielsen Wynant. So he's obviously also a felon of some sort. What is up with this guy? And why does he ever refer to himself as Loopers Unlimited, even if he has committed horrendous crimes?
Did you know that Neil Diamond...
Neil Diamond Phillips?
Neil Diamond's real name is Neil Diamond, a name fit for a rock star.
He changed it to his same name?
No, he was thinking about changing it. He was considering two different possibilities and foregoing his wonderful name, Neil Diamond. One, Ice Cherry.
What?
Yeah, that's real. And the other...
You're just making...
Yeah. Noah Kaminsky.
I was just trying to think as a joke. Is that a joke?
That's not a joke. Neil Diamond...
I was going to say, it would be funny if he was considering changing his name to something overtly Jewish.
Noah Kaminsky.
Because I would believe if you told me his name was Noah Kaminsky and you changed his name to Neil Diamond. That seems like the real story.
It's true.
That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
How do you know that, or why are you making it up? Just to make me look stupid?
I don't know why I know it, but I it's one of those things I know. Natalie Hirschlag. It's somewhere in the Natalie Hirschlag files. The opposite. Natalie Hirschlag. Change your name to Natalie Portman. I get that. Neil Diamond.
Yes, that there's no paucity of examples of people going, I sound too Jewish. Let's change this thing.
Sure. Bob Dylan, what's his real name?
Robert Zimmerman.
There you go. But yeah, Neil Diamond was going to give up Neil Diamond and go with the baffling Ice Cherry or the terrifically mundane Noah Kaminsky.
Wow. All right, that's our show.
We're coming in for a landing even though we never figured out the takeoff.
Yeah, just remember, folks, in every podcast, there's a worst episode. It can't be avoided by definition. It might as well be this one.
In closing, Trump.
Ay, ay, ay.
Thanks for joining us.
We hope you enjoyed whatever this was and that you'll join us for our next whatever it will be.
Until then, you can leave a comment about this rambling mess on our website, thewestwingweekly.com, or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thewestwingweekly.
You can also follow us on Twitter. Hrishikesh is at Hrishi Hirway. I'm at Josh Malina, the silent H.
And our podcast is at West Wing Weekly.
Yeah. It's too late to buy a shirt or a hoodie, but thanks to those who did, you can, as always, buy the West Wing Weekly lapel pin at westwingweekly.com/pin. I feel like somewhere, what if the person who did the closed captioning for this episode is trying to buy one, but they're going westwingweekly.com/////pin and they don't understand why it won't load.
Actually, it would still load.
Oh, really?
No, it wouldn't load.
So you've been lying to me all. You just think because you're an award winner, you can say anything and I'll buy it. And it's true.
It's one of the qualities I try and copy from Sam and the president. The West Wing Weekly is a proud member of Radiotopia.
Yeah, we are.
From PRX, a curated network of extraordinary cutting-edge shows, and we're one of them. To learn more, go to radiotopia.fm.
I've got a little theatrical appearance coming up in Los Angeles, and in a moment we're going to chat with the writers behind The Thrilling Adventure Hour, Ben Blacker and Ben Acker.
I've been to see you in the Thrilling Adventure Hour, and I really liked it. I was your guest along with guest star from Take the Sabbath Day.
Noah Emmerich.
That was pretty exciting. It was no Jamaica with Maureen Dowd at Dulé Hill's house, but it was pretty cool anyway.
Now let's talk to Ben and Ben.
Okay.
All right. So now we're talking to two dear friends of mine and my sometime bosses on Thrilling Adventure Hour, Ben Acker and Ben Blacker. Can you explain to people what the Thrilling Adventure Hour is.
I think we can, but I think you would do it better.
Well, okay, I'll give you my take on it. The Thrilling Adventure Hour, until recently, has been a monthly theatrical event in Los Angeles. My participation goes back about 4 years, and being one of the regular players has been one of the highlights of my time in LA. It's a live, script-in-hand hat tip to all-time radio serials. And you guys have created these characters and these stories, and you've been telling them month by month for 10 years.
That is pretty much it. It's also a podcast on the Nerdist Network. And you are very nice to say how much you enjoyed doing it. When we put you in the show, Ben Acker and I have talked about in the past how we would raid ensemble casts of TV shows that we love. And Sports Night and West Wing was the final cast that we really got to raid.
So in a way, it's yet another job that Aaron helped get.
Yes.
He's been very good to me, even indirectly.
Who are some of the other people in the cast?
The regular cast includes Paul F. Tompkins, Padgett Brewster, whom you know and love from Criminal Minds, among other things, Mark Evan Jackson, who is from Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Craig Kukowski from Drunk History, a million people, Busy Phillips. It's a huge, sprawling cast of...
Mark Cagliardi.
Oh, I have not learned all of their names. I think I've been thinking about this because I listen to the podcast and I'm watching along with you guys. And Ben and I often cite our inspirations as Buffy and the West Wing were huge shows for us. The banter that Aaron writes, and much of that is just about people listening to each other and responding to each other in a quick way. But I think the bigger thing that we took from the West Wing is it's about the smartest people in the room.
But the idea that these characters who are very, very smart couldn't be emotionally dumber if they tried. And that was always a fun juxtaposition to watch as well as to write.
Yeah, that's very well put.
Well, thanks, guys. I'm looking forward to it. I'm coming to come to the show.
Hooray.
I'm so glad you're coming.
So if you're anywhere within driving or really even flying range to get into town to see it, if you haven't seen it live, but you're a fan of the podcast, I encourage you to do so. And where might one procure tickets?
They can go to the Ace Hotel website and look at the calendar there. That's the easiest way. Follow us on Twitter at ThrillingADV.
And wear your West Wing lapel pin and do the signal, and I'll do it back, possibly from stage. Okay.
Okay.
What's
next?
Terrible. Terrible.
It was semi-lifelike. I liked it. Rishi, are you still there?
I'm still here.
Radiotopia.